Let us start today then by taking a brief historical survey of the conditions prevailing in India and the cultures which preceded the influx of the Aryan-speaking people, who were responsible in the course of about 20 to 25 centuries for producing four great indigenous religions, religions which sprang up in India itself. The oldest, of course, is Hinduism. The next two are Jainism and Buddhism. The founder of Jainism was an elder contemporary of the Buddha. And centuries later, after the influx of the conquering Mohammedans, through the interaction of Islam and Hinduism, there arose Sikhism. These are four major religions of the world which are indigenous to India itself. The others which exist in India are impacts upon India from outside. Zarathustrianism, Christianity, Judaism, and of course Islam. And all of them, with the exception of Judaism and Zarathustrianism, numbers millions of followers. This is one of the unique facts about India. No other country in the world is like that. The Hindus number well over 400 million. The Muslims, if we exclude Pakistan, that is, number something like 50 to 60 million in India itself. Then we have approximately 6 million Sikhs, 2 million Jains. We have a large number of Buddhists. Those who are sort of pro-Buddhist enthusiasts like to state that the number of Buddhists runs into 12, 13, 14 millions or something. But as far as I'm aware, those figures are not quite accurate. They are slightly wishful. The number of Buddhists is less than that amount. But I shouldn't be at all surprised if there actually were a few millions of Buddhists in India. See, the bulk of the Buddhist population really is outside India. That's one of the strange things about one of the greatest religions of the world, which sprang up in India itself. And it was the Muslim conquerors who were responsible for the almost complete elimination of Buddhism out of India with their conquests. Then, as regards the Christians, there are about 12 or 13 millions, or maybe a little bit more. The Zarathustrians, because they are such a small group in any case, there are only 120,000 or so in the whole world. The bulk of us, of course, are in India. About 100,000 in India. And there are other 20,000 scattered in other parts of the world. And the Jews, I am quoting only the 1931 census figures, but they cannot be very much more than this figure, in spite of the fact that the population as a whole has increased so very much. It's almost doubled since 1931. The Jews, with that census, numbered about 35,000. But you see, all the major religions of the world are represented there. It is true that Taoists and Confucians are very small in number. But apart from that, this country of India, displays this extraordinary phenomenon of containing and literally mothering all the great religious groups of the world. As far as we know, some scholars think that something like 70 centuries ago, very black-skinned people, Negrito and Proto-Australoid stock, as they are called, came into India from the West. We mustn't get misled by the term Proto-Australoid. Some Austroasiatic peoples may have come up into India from the East, but they were an insignificant number. They were an insignificant number. They all came from the shores of the Mediterranean, North Africa, and Eastern Africa. They must have been quite remarkable people to make that trek, particularly the Proto-Australoids. They are a very good-looking crowd. The Negritos, of course, had the typical Negroid features. But the Proto-Australoids, who are a very good-looking crowd, made that trek for some 2,000 or 2,500 miles across the whole of Western Asia. 70 centuries ago, they walked, no other way, they walked across Western Asia and over the passes of the Hindu Kush Mountains and the Suleiman Mountains, and possibly by the extreme south, by the sea coast, where, of course, the land is not very high. And they entered India that way and spread right through the subcontinent, establishing village communities. These are the first village settlements of which we are aware in the history of India. Now, India in those days was an extremely fertile land, a very rich forest land, plenty of warm rains, and the fall of leaf in the forest, millennium after millennium, had produced this wonderfully fertile soil. Today, what is now Pakistan is very arid, as we all know, large tracts of desert land. But in those days it was richly forested, and it was only three to four thousand years later, that the Indus Valley civilization people chopped down the forests for firewood and for building their cities and so forth, never realizing what would be the consequence. Of course, perhaps other climatic influences were at play and changed that rich forest land into desert land. But this was the condition when the Negritos and Proto-Australoids came. Now, they were favored by the condition of the land and the climate in one way particularly, which made all the difference between India and Central Africa or Central South America. In Africa and in South America, the jungle was too vigorous. Nature was so powerful, so strong, that it was quite impossible to form large, settled communities. the people who formed, made their little villages in Africa and in South America, spent most of their energy in fighting off the encroachments of the forest. And so, culture, art, and the deeper aspects of the intellectual and spiritual life did not have quite the same opportunity to grow as it had in India. This is a factor we mustn't forget. So now, these Negrito and Proto-Australoid peoples, they had at least about 2,000 years before them. And they were such a remarkable people that they pushed right through the entire subcontinent and into southeastern Asia, through the daunting jungles of Malaya and Malaysia, and right into Indonesia. They must have been quite an exceptional sort of people to do that, walking. And of course, where there were small stretches of sea, they made little rafts and boats, whatever they were, and went across. Another factor we must always bear in mind, in connection with the development of everything, materially, culturally, and spiritually in India. Namely, that the northeast of India had this 1,500-mile barrier of the Himalayas, which nobody could cross over, in force, that is. And on the northwest, there was, true enough, not such a great barrier, but nevertheless, something of a barrier, the Hindu Kush Mountains, and beyond them, Afghanistan, which is a pretty arid land. And to the north, especially beyond the 35th, 38th parallel of, say roughly the 40th parallel of latitude, the steppe lands of Central Asia, which were extremely inhospitable. So, then on the east, they had this vast stretch of sea, the Arabians, the Bay of Bengal, which from Madras to Penang is about 1,500 miles. And similarly, the Indian Ocean, from the western coast of India to the shores of Arabia. So, it was protected. It was a self-contained land. And being richly forested, and having so many favorable elements, made for the possibility of a great civilization to arise. We mustn't forget these factors. This contrasts tremendously with what prevailed over the Himalayas and the Pamirs in what is now Tibet, particularly, and China, generally speaking. You know that right to the in the northernmost part of India are the Pamirs, the mountain region, which is the highest, in fact it is, I believe, the highest plateau region in the world. The Himalayas radiate out southeast, 1,500 miles. The Kuenlin Mountains go right across for 2,500 miles into China. Then you have the Altin Tags, the Altais, the Stanovoys, Yablonois, going right up to the Bering Strait. And you've got this vast Arctic hinterland, which we have in the past we called Siberia, now the part of the Soviet Union. And between the Caspian and the Pamirs was a tract which was peopled by pastoral nomads. We'll talk about them just a little later. First, with regard to these Negritos and Proto-Australoids. They are important for this reason. They, as far as we know, made the first village settlements. Up till certainly the middle of the last century, it was the fashion to regard these peoples as a primitive, somewhat savage, uncultured crowd. Today we are a little bit wiser, and we have learned our wisdom with a certain degree of pain, and we see that it would be very rash to call them savages. They were far from savage. They were a totemistic people, and they lived peaceably according to their particular system of law. They had their own rules and regulations. Now, they had certain beliefs which are of very great interest. One of their beliefs was that there was an indestructible life essence which resided in the head. At death, that life essence went into the soil and it came out in the crops which were grown upon that soil. If a pregnant woman ate of those crops, that life essence would quicken the fetus in her womb and a human being would be born. Now, this primitive belief is supposed to lie at the foundation of the ideas which in the course of development culminated in the popular conception of reincarnation. Also, supposing an animal ate of that fruit or whatever was grown and so forth, and if the pregnant woman ate the flesh of the animal, then that life essence would do the needful and there would come another human being. So you see, they believed in the continuity of an indestructible life essence. Now, this is a very interesting thing. The continuity of an indestructible life essence. You will see in this idea that it resided in the head. One of the origins of the practice of head hunting, for instance. See, then you really got hold of your enemy. And they all, you know, they always split open the skull. The victors split open the skulls of the vanquished. Now, in addition to that, they believed that every living human being had some wonderful magical essence, some proper magical property. They called it mana or aran. If a man made a pot or cooked a meal or did anything whatsoever which was specifically his own action, and especially if it was his very own special technique or gift, then his mana, his magic, went into this object. You see? Now, if a man from another totem approached a man from this totem, if the two totems were regarded as harmonious ones, all right, you could have social contact, you could marry, the two harmonious totems could intermarry, and they could dine together. But you mustn't intermarry or dine with people who belong to an inimical totem, a disharmonious totem. So you see, the origins of what became such a terrible thing when the caste system, thousands of years later, began to undergo its degenerative stages, not when it was absolutely in first-class condition, but in its degenerative stages, these ideas about commensality and intermarriage made for such rigid separation between social groups. And this was all done in the name of religion, religion in this case being understood as that which dealt with the psychical, with magic power. You see? Now, these influences were at play and have been at play and are still at play in certain remote parts of India after 70 centuries. Because one of the astonishing things about the history of India is the fact that these extremely ancient cultures, in small groups, in the fastnesses, in the hills, in the Nilgiri region, the Chota Nagpur region, and in the Himalayan regions, small groups of people who still live exactly as they did 60 and 70 centuries ago. That is why India is such a happy hunting ground for anthropologists and so forth. Here you can study before your eyes the way of life and the practices of people who have not changed for 6,000 or 7,000 years. So we must bear this in mind and remember that they were in the majority. Now on them, roughly about 5,000 years ago, came the impact of a highly cultured, developed Sumerian and Armenian group. I mention the Sumerians and Armenians because they are specially important. There were other groups too, but these two are the really important ones. The Armenians particularly, they were the broad-headed, brachycephalic people. The others were dolichocephalic, that is to say long-headed, rather than broad-headed. The Armenians, the broad-headed ones, were first-class builders. They were very practical, builders of cities. And they came from Elam, Kish, Lagash, Ur, Eridu, and all these places in the Euphrates-Tigris region. And they brought with them their own culture, established it in, first of all, in the Indus Valley region. You have all heard about the Indus Valley civilization, and built cities. And they ushered in the second great stage in the development of Indian life and religion. These city-states, for their culture, are perfectly comparable with modern city-states. When I say modern, during the early part of the second millennium after Christ, you see, in Europe or anywhere else, quite comparable to them. They were skilled workers in gold, silver, ivory, semi-precious gems, and all that sort of thing. Their handiwork, which has been dug up, is something quite remarkable, exquisite stuff, great skill. Their cities were well planned. Perhaps our borough council should visit the remains of Harappa and Mohenjo-daro and see how they planned their cities. Great public baths. Palaces are hardly known, but temples, yes. And from all the evidence that has been gathered, it seems as if, in the majority of cases, the Indus Valley civilization was a republican order rather than a monarchical order. A republican order. They had indoor sanitation, most ingeniously contrived drainage systems and all the rest of it. And this is, remember, starting about 5,000 years ago. Now, the point we may mention here, but which is none, as far as I'm aware, never touched upon by scholars, is this. These people who came round about 3000 BC from Armenia and Sumeria correspond, if we are to accept the conventional dates in Genesis, with the period of Enoch, who was seventh in the line from Adam, round about 3000 BC. It's a very interesting thing. You know that roughly about 2000 BC, Abraham gets the call, receives the call, and goes westward, and we have Judaism come into being in full strength and so forth. But these people, approximately 1,000 years earlier, came eastwards into India. Now, is it impossible that they brought with them the wisdom of the Kabbalah? I don't think it is impossible at all. There is a certain amount of good evidence, I feel, which would support this view. We won't go into that now, because it's rather a lot to talk about, and in any case, it is just what I myself have felt and thought about it. But it might be a subject for future scholars to investigate. They introduced the esoteric wisdom of the Kabbalah. You will find extraordinary resemblances between the Kabbalistic teachings, especially their symbolism, with, say, the symbolism in yoga. If you look at that picture over there, you will see that the Star of David, the six-pointed star, is one of the symbols which is used in yoga. And that is pure Indian yoga. Now, how does that culture and this culture, supposed to be so different, unrelated? The race talks certainly are different. We are Indo-European, they are Semitic. See? How is it that these two different groups have similar symbols? I won't be surprised if then the wisdom of the Kabbalah came in with the Indus Valley people. They developed music, mathematics, astronomy to a remarkable degree. And you may recall that these are three of the seven keys to unlock the mysteries of esoteric wisdom: music, mathematics, astronomy, and their related subjects. The others are philosophy, biology, chemistry, yoga. These are the seven keys. I mentioned the word astronomy, but astronomy in those days was inextricably interwoven with astrology. And you may remember that when we have talked a little bit about the zodiac in our meetings, I have pointed out that if you approach the understanding of astrology in terms of the attempt to understand the different states of consciousness which determine individual human life, then you will probably come nearer the heart of the underlying truth, the truth which underlies astrology. See? So that stemmed from astronomy. You know, for instance, in Plato's Academy, what an important part music, mathematics, and astronomy played, as well as, of course, philosophy. He didn't stress astronomy very much, but music, mathematics, and philosophy were the subjects that Plato emphasized. But way back in the time of Pythagoras, we had the same sort of idea. Well, now, you get these correspondences, so it is not unlikely that the wisdom of the Kabbalah did enter into India with these Indus Valley people. They established the city-states, but of course, being human beings like ordinary human beings, they had their tremendous conceit and sense of separateness from the Negrito and Proto-Australoid groups who were mere hewers of wood and drawers of water, and so forth. Also, these were a brown-skinned type, nowhere near so black-skinned or dark, in any case, as the Negrito-Australoid groups, particularly the Negrito groups. Now, the Indus Valley people spread right across the whole of the Indo-Gangetic Plain. Not right into Bengal, perhaps, but the greater part of the Indo-Gangetic Plain. Now, we must bear this carefully in mind, because their ideas and beliefs, their ritual systems and so forth, have had a very, an enormous influence in the emergence of the whole of Brahmanical and Hindu teaching and of Buddhist teaching and so forth. You see? Then they went southwards along the western coast and turned in towards the east, towards Madras. Those were their main sort of regions. Those were the main regions which they occupied and which they influenced, and where they left the all the traces and influences of their culture. Now, as regards the religion of these people, the Indus Valley people, we have plenty of evidence in terms of objects, all kinds of objects, from which scholars have drawn various conclusions. The influence of Crete and of Asia Minor is seen in all this, mainly, you see, and the different symbols that they utilized. They had no writing as we know it. They had a pictographic script which they engraved upon these objects. And that script still remains undeciphered. Unfortunately for us, no Rosetta Stone has been discovered which could show the correspondences between that script and, say, Vedic or Sanskrit or something like that. Well, now, they flourished for at least 1500 years with this civilized order. And on them came the impact of our ancestors, the Aryan-speaking peoples, who some scholars say originally came from the Ukraine, the rich black earth lands of southern Russia, and others believe came from the land, the steppe lands of Central Asia, between the Caspian and right across north of Tibet and into Siberia, you see. The question arises, why did they come? What made them come? Consider the climate of the lands in which they lived, and consider the fact that they were pastoral nomads. The steppe lands of Central Asia can by no means be called rich, fertile lands where you could settle down comfortably. That's one point. They were semi-arid lands. Temperatures, places like Tomsk and Krasnoyarsk, with -2 and -12 as midwinter temperatures. A little further north, Yakutsk, -45, you see, And if you did go right up into places like Verkhoyansk, the temperature in midwinter could fall to a charming minus 94. And in midsummer, go up to plus 90. So that the variation between the plus 90 of midsummer and the minus 94 of midwinter is 4 degrees more than the range between ice and boiling water. It gives you an idea why people occasionally want to make a move. Now it happened, apparently it happened that driven by drought, the Aryan-speaking peoples of these steppe lands came southwards. They came through Afghanistan to a place called Nishaya. No one knows for certain where exactly Nishaya is on the map. There is a Nishapur in Afghanistan in modern times, but Nishaya, one is not quite certain. And there, apparently, they separated into two groups. One group, the Rig Vedic Indo-Aryans, went into over the Hindu Kush passes into India, and the other group went westwards into Iran, right as far as Azerbaijan, and settled there. This we know for a historical fact that from 1746 BC onwards, there were Aryan princes who were ruling in the region called the Mitanni. Why did they separate? Apparently, the one group who were the who became the Zarathustrians of later centuries insisted upon the worship of a single god, and the others wanted to stick to their worship of many gods. Now, these Aryan-speaking people were the people who brought the Rig Veda with them. They were a tall, virile, very fair-skinned, haughty, vigorous people. And they came armed with horse and sword, which gave them military advantage over all their opponents. I should have said the iron sword. The others had bronze swords. The horse and the iron sword proved the instruments of decision for their victory and their conquests. They brought with them the Rig Veda. Although they were a rude, intruding group, pastoral nomads, they had the Rig Veda with them. Now, scholars are inclined to present the Rig Veda and give descriptions of it in terms like these. It is a collection of hymns, the earliest document of the human mind, representing the religion of an unsophisticated age, the creation of inspired poets and seers. Inspired poets and seers. Many of the hymns, it is said, are simple and naive in praise of nature gods and goddesses. Some deal with formal ritual, and others, especially in the last book, the 10th, present the results of conscious reflections on the origin of the world and on the Supreme Being. But no system of philosophy is presented at this stage, for mythology and poetry precede philosophy and science. We might well question, how is it that a people who, as far as the ordinary ways of life are concerned, were certainly a backward people, they were more or less to use the Greek word, hoi barbaroi. They were barbarians. How is it that barbarians produced a Rig Veda, which is so superior to any of the religious systems, as far as we know, from scholarly research, which prevailed anywhere else? I think we have to understand the Rig Veda in a different way. If we free our minds from the conditioning which makes us, which gives us a bias against ancient people being able to produce highly developed religion, we will see that the hymns of the Rig Veda actually represent, in poetic form, the different states of mind and consciousness through which the religious people went on their way to the realization of transcendence. Of course, one will question, but you study the hymns of the Rig Veda. They seem obviously a polytheistic nature religion. There are all sorts of beliefs in gods and goddesses and so forth, and they are presented as entities and all the rest of it. But we could ask a counter question. In what other literary form could it have been possible for those people to present their religious realizations other than the anthropomorphic? You see, the mind of man in those days, remember, this is something like quite 35 to 40 centuries ago. The mind of man in those days conceived of all the processes of life and of nature and their ordinary everyday experience in terms of spirits which embodied themselves in everything. In stones, the earth, in trees, in rivers, in mountains, in the lightning and thunder and the sun and the moon and themselves and all the rest of it. This was their language, so to say, of expression. They couldn't possibly present their profound religious findings in any other than anthropomorphic terms, terms of the gods. And they expressed their profound reverence, their awe. They also expressed their intimate relationship, their personal communications with the gods. If we were to say that these people were a backward, primitive people, we must equally well say that those who produced the first chapters of Genesis were equally backward. Adam and God are on speaking terms. Shouldn't we? Now, look deeply into the hymns of the Rig Veda and see what could be the significance of their presentation. Let me just read one suggestive paragraph. The Vedas are essentially the expressions of the transformations of mind and consciousness experienced in the living process of the fruition of holiness, starting with the first metanoia, the turning away, the conversion, so to say, the lovely dawn vision of holy living. That's the first stage, represented by the goddess Ushas. aurora, the Greek eos, the dawn. This is what the goddess Ushas represents, the first dawn vision of holiness and its significance and meaning. Onward through the upholding of righteousness, represented by the god Varuna, who in the Rig Veda is presented as the moral governor of the universe. The triumph of spiritual victory, represented by the god Indra, a sort of a correspondent of the thundering Yahweh. Indra holds the thunderbolt. He does marvelous things all through the Rig Veda. And unfortunately, the recital of those marvelous things, and particularly the statement in some of the hymns that he drank soma so much, you see, the intoxicating liquor of the gods, so that you became divinely intoxicated. All those have been somewhat misunderstood by ordinary scholarship. The utter purification of the soul by the Lord of Fire, Agni. The inspirational flight of the alone to the alone, which is the real meaning, I would say, of the god Soma, the god of inspiration. They have talked of Soma as the drink. And of course there are so many hymns in the Rig Veda which are couched in such a form that it is very difficult for any scholar not to come to the conclusion that Soma was an actual physical liquor brewed out of certain plants. You see? John Allegro in our times has even made Soma into a mushroom. And so has he made Jesus, hasn't he? Some sort of psychedelic drug or some such thing. Horrible, the extent to which scholarship can go. The flight of the alone to the alone in supreme communion and the blazing forth of the light of realized transcendence, represented by Aditya, the sun in the unclouded heavens. So they use this sort of naturalistic terminology in order to symbolize what they realized within themselves. Now, if the gods really mean that sort of thing, which I have suggested here, then we can go on to see to say that such is the one who has realized the Atma, which is the phrase used in the Upanishads. Such is Brahman. And the realized transcendence authorizes the Holy One to affirm, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. The Veda cannot be read by mere intellectual genius. It has to be seen by vision. It has to be heard by revelation. And this is true of all the scriptures. Perhaps this is a good place to stop today. Next time we'll go into some of the hymns, the actual hymns, and I will try and suggest how we may understand the inner meaning of what is put in the hymns of the Rig Veda.